This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, it's been just over a month now since healthcare reform has passed, and the administration is moving forward pretty aggressively to make sure the implementation plans goes forward on what some say is the biggest transformation of government since World War II. Margaret, I don't know what your thoughts are, but when I hear that statement, I'm reminded of Daniel Moynihan's quip, "Everyone is entitled to their own opinion, but they are not entitled to their own facts." What's your opinion on this?
Well, it's a yes or no answer. It is a radical transformation on some level because we're certainly trying to move towards universal coverage and access to healthcare in a way we haven't done before. You know, maybe it's because we live in the world of healthcare every day, but I don't see this as a big transformation of government. Instead, I think we're really building on a lot of infrastructure already in place. And I think of it as making the country and healthcare better for that next generation of both consumers and providers.
That's the right attitude. Granted, the law's main provision won't take effect until 2014, but a lot is happening right now to get the process going and on the right track. The states are working on their high-risk pools to make sure people with serious pre-existing conditions can get affordable coverage now. And I imagine the insurance companies are very focused in on this new reality that includes dealing with the elimination of pre-existing conditions, but also a huge new market pool that's coming their way. I'm a little concerned about what's going to happen in the next 2 years in terms of insurance premiums. Those insurance companies need to keep those premiums in check.
Well, a little antidote to that worry is some welcome news. The White House made it official in an announcement on Monday that they're nominating Dr. Don Berwick to head the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. We've talked about him earlier and his tremendous track record in patient safety and innovation. And we're going to be waiting patiently over the next several weeks as he goes through the Senate hearings and hopefully towards confirmation. And another piece of good news, the president has tapped a very highly respected Senate staffer, Peter Rouse, to head up the implementation effort. He'll be joining Nancy DeParle, who's been convinced to stay on, along with Secretary Sebelius from HHS. That's a formidable team, and they're going to need all the talent they can get.
They are. Pete Rouse, though, is a great choice. Senate credentials are impeccable. Obama's chief of staff. And then on with Tom Daschle as both the majority and minority chief of staff when Daschle was in power. I want to stay on topic, though, about the new implementation and the new departments that are being created. There's the new Office of Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight. We hear from Politico that John Kingsdale might be up for that appointment.
That's another great pick. Now let's turn our attention to today's guest. We're going to speak with Dr. Danielle Ofri, an attending physician at Bellevue Hospital in New York City. She's written a new book, Medicine in Translation, Journeys with My Patients. Her stories of her patients' lives, both before they came to the U.S., their lives here, and her experience as a doctor caring for them are both memorable and they're very instructive as we grapple with the issue of how we're going to provide health care for immigrants, many of whom won't qualify for insurance even under reform.
No matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website at CHC Radio. We'd also like to give a special shout-out to WPRR 1680 AM and 95.3 Public Reality Radio in Grand Rapids, Michigan. They will be airing our show starting this week on Friday at 5 p.m.
Hello, Michigan. And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Now, before we speak with Dr. Ofri, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, for headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. As the Department of Health and Human Services forges on with developing and implementing the major reforms that go into effect this year, as well as in 2014, a new Office of Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight will be there to help. The office will facilitate and administer the temporary high-risk pools, set to be ready in June in states that choose to take part, and it will establish and oversee new rules on medical loss ratios and the state-based insurance exchanges that will take over in 2014. As HHS continues to refine certain regulations in the new law, we're also hearing about some more good news for college students and young adults, another group of Americans who will reap an immediate benefit of healthcare reform. As it stands now, the law requires insurers to offer coverage of dependents up to age 26 to stay on their parents' health plans starting in September. But HHS announced it was working with insurers to voluntarily provide coverage for graduating college seniors and young adults In advance of the September start date, Nancy Ann DeParle, director of the White House Office of Health Reform, welcomed the news.
Some companies may come forward on their own. The secretary has been working with them and has asked them to go ahead and keep some people on who might otherwise go off. And I actually met with some companies today who said they might reach out and allow people to come on early.
In fact, two of the largest health insurers, United Health Group and WellPoint, came forward on Monday with plans to allow college seniors to stay on their parents' health plans right after graduation this spring. The move is a good sign that insurance companies are moving quickly to comply with the new law's provisions. Both insurers' plans will take effect June 1st. Today, we're exploring immigration and health care, and a large part of delivering quality care to a diverse group of people is being able to speak the same language as the patient. Joint Commission accreditation requires that healthcare providers address effective communication, cultural competence, and patient-centered care. One useful service that accomplishes this goal, that's also used here at the Community Health Center, is a translation service called LanguageLine. It connects the healthcare worker to a certified medical interpreter within seconds. I visited New York Hospital Queens, that services one of the most diverse communities in New York, to see how a language line works and why it's so important. I'm here in the pediatrics emergency room with Kendra Haydell, the language assistant coordinator at New York Hospital Queens. She tells me that the language line service is used most often in here because the emergency room is usually the first point of entry for the patient.
This is sort of like our first line of providing language assistance, or our first encounter starts here. Once they come through, they are asked, what is your preferred language? And at that moment, if they say anything other than English, then that's where the chain of events take place, where it's like, okay, now we know we're going to treat a patient in bed 11. They speak X, Y, and Z, and then language services are then put in place.
Several cordless telephones are within reach for doctors and nurses to take into a patient's room. The process is quick and easy.
All the staff has to do is push the talk button. It's going to automatically dial to language line, and then there's a second handset that they would give to the patient. Yes, operator?
I will be connecting you with interpreter number 7757.
Thank you. Hi, interpreter.
Hello.
Haydell tells me that about 40% of the hospital's inpatients are what's considered LEPs, limited English proficient patients. In other words, the hospital relies on the service a lot. The hospital has been using LanguageLine and the 170 languages and dialects it offers for almost 20 years now. Recently, starting in 2007, the hospital began piloting a video interpreting service, which provides translation in Spanish and English sign language, as well as the hospital's most frequently used languages, Spanish, Mandarin, Korean, and soon to come, Russian. I'm impressed when Haydell shows me a pamphlet that staff members have on hand. It conveniently lets patients point to the dialect they speak.
For example, patients can point here, and so even if, you know, they come in, and especially with this being an emergency room area, if, you know, they can't speak because they're in too much pain, at least they can point and say, okay, here, this is, speak Polish. And then this way we can get someone who speaks their language.
Donna Pecoraro, a nurse on duty today in the PED, tells me that with LanguageLine, there's never any second guessing what a patient is saying.
We can get the story from beginning to end without missing anything in between from the parent through the language line, through our translator. Upon discharge, it's so much easier to clearly give the parents teaching instructions that they're going to need as far as medications that they have to give or what to look out for.
And as we all know, that's key for better patient outcomes and lower readmission rates. As Haydell puts it, we make sure that when they're discharged in good health. Let's listen now to our guest interview to get a more personal perspective on how healthcare workers deal with patients from a diverse set of backgrounds.
The
This is Conversations in Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. Danielle Ofri, a physician at Bellevue Hospital in New York City, co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Bellevue Literary Review, and author of a new book, Medicine in Translation, Journeys with My Patients, published by Beacon Press. Welcome, Dr. Ofri.
Thank you so much.
Your book underscores the complexity regarding immigrant rights to healthcare in our country, a very relevant and important topic, and one that continues to feed the debate over healthcare reform. You give us a very clear picture of this complexity with your story of one of your patients, Julio Barquera, a 36-year-old woman from Guatemala who has severe heart conditions and will die unless she receives a transplant. Can you tell us her story?
Sure. I met Julio as a young woman in her early 30s when she presented to our hospital with severe congestive heart failure. It turned out she had a genetic cardiac disease for which she will eventually die from, and normally we cure this with a heart transplant. But she's undocumented, and as such, she can't be on the list for an organ transplant. I've now followed her for several years. She's a wonderful woman who would otherwise be an excellent candidate, otherwise healthy, reliable, smart, but can't get this heart transplant. And so one of the issues when it first happened is no one had the guts to tell her. We were all felt so horrible and so terrible, but telling her, you know, to a person that she can't get a heart transplant took us a long time to break the news. And now we feel as though we're just in a waiting game. Like one day the shoe is going to fall and we won't be able to help her.
Dr. Ofri, there's a compelling humanitarian argument, and I think you've just made it, and a moral argument to be made for providing health care for undocumented immigrants. And but beyond that, I think the public health community in particular would argue it's just short-sighted for us not to provide health care, since ultimately emergency treatment at least is always rendered. And another argument is that the children of both documented and undocumented immigrants, if born here in the U.S., automatically are citizens, qualify for health care, and thus it's just short-sighted not to provide primary and preventive care, like prenatal care, for instance. So we have practical, financial, moral, and emotional arguments being made. I wonder if you could sort out for our listeners the arguments we're likely to hear over the next year as the debate unfolds concerning immigrants' rights to health care in this country and under health reform.
Well, I think that to some degree, immigration is a bit of a red herring in the health care debate. I think that it plays well in terms of sound bites and ads about people taking advantage of the system, and we would solve everything if these weren't the problem. But the truth is, this is really a side issue. I think our health care system has serious issues that need to be resolved, whether or not immigrants are part of the picture. The fact that we have uninsured people, American citizens, seems like an unethical thing from a professional and medical standpoint. And so I think that it's an easy way to channel some of the anger and resentment toward the immigrants. But you're right, I think that there are compelling reasons. And I can understand the philosophical debate that, well, if someone's illegal here, they shouldn't get an organ. I can even appreciate that. But the problem is, well, what happens on the human level? What happens to the doctors and nurses who take care of this young woman and have to tell her this and watch her die? We don't have anything in our medical training that says, here's how you tell someone they can't get the care mm-hmm. that they would otherwise deserve. So it's very fraught, and I think we haven't paid much attention to the basic humanitarian issues. In terms of cost, you're right, it probably makes much more sense to give everyone free primary care and avoid costly complications later.
Every patient you describe in your book, Medicine in Translation, is an immigrant, and they come from all corners of the globe. You deal with language barriers, gaps in understanding of different cultures, the trauma of previous lives on a daily basis, and that's just one of the struggles you faced in treating such a diverse group of patients. What comes through in your book is just how much work you do to coordinate their care, advocate for your patients, get resources for them, work often not associated with physicians. Tell us about how you deal with the language and cultural barriers, but also at this important juncture in health reform goes forward, who else do you have on your team that helps you with all these important non-medical challenges?
Well, I think that highlights the predicament of all primary care doctors, general internists, pediatricians, who are sort of the first step for people in the healthcare system. We do a lot of coordinating, a lot of non-medical work. Even places that are better staffed than where I work, even that still requires a lot of work from a doctor that is not reimbursed. And it's hard to imagine, for example, a lawyer putting in all the time and not billing by the minute for the extra phone calls and forms. But that seems to be part of the deal for medicine. I think we haven't recognized that it's impossible to provide good care in 15 minutes and do all these things that are required. I mean, good care isn't just the medicine. It's all the other parts that come together, making sure the patient has the right home services, that they get their prescriptions refilled, that they can understand their medications. So a lot of us look for the idea of a medical home where there's a team who would be helping a patient's care. Now, there's a social worker who can help coordinate services, maybe a pharmacist who can go over the medications, and a nurse who can coordinate much of the screening. I think someone estimated once that for a doctor to do all the right screening and primary care interventions would take an eight-hour visit. So it's not, even though we demand it, it's not possible.
Dr. Ofri, when you decided to take that year off in Costa Rica, which sounded wonderful, you took your husband and two young children with you, and you gave birth to your third child while you were there. Now, we've often heard that Costa Rica has a very good primary care system in particular. What were your observations on the health system there as compared to the United States? How did you view the experience of being the foreigner, if you will, in another country and their health system? And any lessons learned that you brought back to your work at Bellevue?
Well, I had a wonderful experience having a child in Costa Rica on all fronts. I mean, the medical care was excellent. I had a just wonderful, I felt very safe and cared for. But I also found the entire society, and this includes the medical staff, is just much calmer and slower, but is also oriented towards children in a way that I didn't see here. The amount of help people gave me on the street, in the community. I would walk into a store, someone would hold your child while you shop at the bank. They would bring you to the front of the line if you had a baby with you. So I felt the healthcare was excellent. Some of the things I learned, though, was when you don't speak the primary language, even if you have education and resources, it's still going to be challenging. For example, making an appointment over the phone in a second language is very hard. When you don't have body language and things to clue you in, I really struggled to make my appointments. And even though my doctor spoke English, the nurses didn't, the administrators didn't. So I realized how difficult it could be, even with all the resources that I brought to it. And I look at my patients who are much sicker, maybe have fewer resources, how challenging it is, how many that are just may get lost just getting to the hospital.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Daniel Ofri, a physician at Bellevue Hospital in New York City and author of Medicine in Translation, Journeys with My Patient. There was one patient whom you treated at the end of her life, Mrs. Ling. After her death, you found that she decided to stay in the United States when she was diagnosed with cancer because she thought she'd receive better care here than she would if she returned to China. Can you tell us her story and what did it reveal to you?
Well, her story, as I learned later, that she came to America on a vacation to see her siblings, leaving her young son and husband behind for just a few weeks, and then became sick while she was here. And she decided to stay in America because she felt she would get better care. She ended up spending 5 years in America and was never able to see her family again. Her family wasn't able to come. And in the end, her family, their most fervent wish for her that she wanted was to have her body sent back to China to go home. And so she was only reunited with her son and husband in death, and they brought her body home to her family for burial.
Mm. Powerful stories in your book, and I'd like to ask you about one more of them. Your patient, Dr. Chan, who decides to do the opposite almost, leave his elderly wife who's in the mid-stage of Alzheimer's disease here, and he would return to his homeland of China to spend his last years. And it raises the issues of the elderly, which are such a concern to all of us. And while the health reform legislation we've just passed includes much more support for the elderly, I think we still have to ask the question, how well prepared is our country to meet the health care needs of the elderly? And what are you doing at Bellevue in this area that you think is innovative around supporting health care for the elderly?
It is a real issue. The elderly will be the fastest growing segment of the population, certainly the ones with the most medical needs. And this particular couple was a sweet elderly couple who they lived in my neighborhood, so I was able to kind of keep tabs on them. And in fact, I wrote about them just because they were such an interesting couple before he announced he was going back to China. So it was quite a shock that he decided that he needed for his health to be in China where he felt more supported. He felt that, you know, he didn't have the support here. And I think that's very important. A lot of elderly are isolated, may not have family, or their family have families of their own and can't be there around the clock. And it's quite an arduous experience to navigate the healthcare system for someone who's frail and elderly who may or may not speak English, to fill out forms, to navigate phone trees. It's very, very tricky. I think many people get lost by the wayside. I think the field of geriatrics is expanding for that. And again, having some kind of medical team where there are social workers and visiting nurses, because I think people can really get lost between the tracks.
Dr. Ofri, you wrote about the importance of knowing and understanding someone's backstory. You take care of patients from NYU's Survivors of Torture Clinic. Caring for these patients requires such sensitivity. How were you trained to care for these unique patients?
I think there's no training that you can get from a book for this. And I think that comes to all of the parts of medicine, you know, dealing with other cultures, dealing with patients who are smelly, distasteful, angry, who have come from backgrounds that they were very abused. I think all of this is things you learn on the job, and I think from watching your senior attendings, your senior physicians, your leaders, walking the walk more than talking the talk, mm-hmm. and demonstrating humanitarianism and professionalism is how the students learn how to be the doctor they want to be.
Dr. Ofri, speaking of students, you practice at a teaching center and are training the next generation. That's part of Bellevue's mission. Medical schools and other health professional schools are increasingly seeing the power in narratives, writing the patient's story as a valuable tool to use in understanding the patient experience instead of just recording the objective data. And we do this in our organization with our nurse practitioner residency training program as well. Columbia University's even set up a whole program in training health professionals to write narratives. As a writer yourself, how do you think this might contribute to improving both the quality of care and also satisfaction for patients and providers?
I think there's an enormous contribution. For the students that I supervise, they always have to hand in their write-ups of patients, and I ask them to do one of them just in the narrative form, just to tell the patient's story, and it's amazing how often it's clinically relevant. One short example, I had a student interview a young woman with asthma, and she and her boyfriend had a dog, and she knew the dog worsened her asthma, but she didn't want to get rid of the dog because her boyfriend would be crushed. So then the student interviewed the boyfriend for another point of view. He said, oh, we should get rid of the dog, but she would be crushed. So she got them together, and they realized they could actually give the dog to a friend, and her asthma got better. So by going into the story of the experience of the illness, not only is it interesting and help us know the patients more, there are valuable clinical and therapeutic insights.
Dr. Ofri, when you look around the country and the world, what do you see that excites you in terms of innovations, and who should our listeners of Conversations be keeping an eye on?
I think it's the upcoming students and interns. Despite what everyone says on medicine isn't the way it used to be, I look at these incoming students and interns and residents, and they're still full of idealism. They are in medicine for the right reason. There's no one in medicine to make money or get prestige, because there's easier places to get money and prestige. And I feel as though my own idealism is you know, fortified with each new group coming through. So I would say keep an eye on the young people. The classes are incredibly diverse now. Mm-hmm. There's a majority of women in many medical schools, many, many more minorities, people from different backgrounds, people from non-traditional backgrounds coming in later, studying humanities. And these are the doctors who are going to, I think, be the leaders.
Great. Today we've been speaking with Dr. Danielle Ofri, physician at Bellevue Hospital in New York City and author of the new book, Medicine in Translation, Journeys with My Patients. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Ofri.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
This week's bright idea focuses on a new discovery that's helping patients who suffer from Parkinson's disease to stay healthy and cope with pain, and it might teach us all a few things. Parkinson's disease is a degenerative disorder of the central nervous system that's both chronic and progressive, so it persists and worsens over time. Even in the less severe earlier stages, Parkinson's can seriously disrupt everyday activities, leaving patients unable to walk or talk. Over 1 million Americans suffer from Parkinson's, and 50,000 new cases are diagnosed each year. Although some treatments do exist to lessen the severity of the symptoms, none have succeeded in completely halting the disease progression. But several months ago, Dr. Bastiaan Bloem of the Netherlands began exploring a new treatment that not only is helping to ease patients' physical and psychological pain in real time, but may also change the direction of Parkinson's research and treatment in the future. During an exam, one of Dr. Bloem's patients informed him that, although he was virtually unable to walk, he regularly rode his bicycle around the neighborhood for miles at a time. After seeing his patient bicycling in person, Dr. Bloem began testing his other patients, and he saw the same results over and over. On the bike, the symptomless patients rode with ease and agility, but as soon as they dismounted, symptoms returned immediately. Dr. Bloem's research is still in the beginning stages. He's only been experimenting with cycling therapy for a few months, but the research has the potential to affect significant change in the understanding and the patient experience of Parkinson's. Dr. Bloem and his colleagues hypothesize that Parkinson's patients are able to cycle because bicycling uses a completely different part of the brain that's not as compromised by the disease. Another hypothesis is that the rhythmic nature of cycling helps the nervous system to allow the continuous motion. Further exploration into these areas may lead to a more complex understanding of the disease, how to best treat it, but also how to live well with it. Research prospects aside, cycling allows Parkinson patients to experience a sense of freedom and normalcy that their condition frequently denies them. They experience this psychologic relief while getting valuable exercise. Research, it's still in its initial stages, but it's already making a difference for individual patients, and it has the potential to help others. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health.